Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
If you're thinking of putting together a dinner party, don't invite Bill Kristol and Donald Trump, because one of them probably won't come. Bill has been a leading conservative commentator for several decades. He was the chief of staff to then-Vice President Dan Quayle, and has a long history in the conservative movement, but was one of the sharpest critics of Donald Trump throughout the campaign and to this day. He's also a member of the board of the Institute of Politics and came by to participate in a panel on the future of the Republican Party in the Trump era and to sit down with me. Bill Kristol, welcome. Not only an eminent conservative voice in our country, but also a member of the board of the Institute of Politics, which is equally important to me.
By far the most important thing. And it's an honor to be here, and good to be here with you.
So you kind of come from New York City sort of intellectual royalty. You grew up in an interesting environment. And, I grew up in New York at about the same time, so your dad's name in particular was one that I was familiar with. Talk about your family a little and the way you grew up.
So I grew up in New York, and my father was a writer and book publisher and editor, my mother a historian, but like most kids, I followed sports more than anything else. And the most memorable thing of my youth was the great year of my junior and senior year in high school, 68 to 70, I guess.
Yes, I was there, man.
You were
there.
The
Mets.
Well, we had everything, right? We had the Mets in September 69. The Jets, the beginning of 69, yeah. Winning the Super Bowl, the first great AFC, I guess we have to call it, victory over the Colts, and then the Mets in that September, and then culminating at just after
the week,
just as I graduated in the summer of 70 with Willis Reed in the seventh game against the Lakers. And everything since then has been downhill, basically, life peaked at age 17.
That was an astonishing run, man, to be in New York at that time. I'm a Chicagoan now, so I have to keep it on the down low that I was a Mets fan back then, because as you remember, the Cubs collapsed.
Well, they made up for it now, 40, how many years later is this? Yeah. 46 years later.
It took a
that
while.
That was fantastic.
It took a while. Claire McCaskill, who's a big Cardinals fan, tweeted the other day that we're only entitled to a title every 100 years. So I hope she's wrong about that.
I was rooting against the Cubs and for the Indians. I don't care much about either team, but on the conservative grounds, that why break a 108-year-old streak? You know, it's one of the great institutions in American life that the Cubs cannot win the World Series, and now it's gone. Just like so many institutions are being destroyed here in America, and traditions and norms. You know, but okay. So
Because they made an interesting intellectual journey from the left, to conservatism, and there were others who followed.
Right.
So talk a little bit about.
So they were kind of Cold War liberals, I think one would say. I remember my father supported Humphrey, for example, in '68. So he wasn't for McCarthy or Kennedy. He was in that respect a kind of. I supported Scoop Jackson. First campaign I volunteered in was Scoop Jackson in '72. So kind of those old fashioned labor Cold War Democrats. My father.
But going down back in the day.
Yes.
They were sort of. Trotskyites.
Well, way back in the day, they were Trotskyites when they were in college. They met at a Trotskyite meeting, I think, when my father maybe was already in college. My mother was in high school in Brooklyn. So that was in the late 30s, in the middle of the Depression, before World War II, obviously. My father, actually, they came out here to Chicago. My mother got her PhD here. I think one of the first women to get a PhD at Chicago in history, having gone to Brooklyn College. My father was in the war. I think that cured him. He wrote later, being in the war of sort of socialist delusions and about the world and about also his fellow citizens. So he saw sort of life is more complicated. And so he became, I'd say, a traditional Cold War liberal, though he always had more interest in kind of conservative critiques of progressivism, I guess I put it that way. He was sympathetic to religion, sympathetic to, doubtful of the kind of utopianism of some progressives. He went to London in the 50s and edited a magazine called Encounter, which was a very well-respected intellectual magazine, a lot of literary stuff as well as political things. Came back to New York. That's where I grew up.
So
in
you
the
spent
60s.
So you spent some time in
London.
London.
We left when I was 6 years old. So I and the only thing I don't really remember it at all. I was told later that I had a British accent. I'd been there from when I was 6 months old to when I was 6 years old, and I was told later that I had a British accent when I came back as a 6 year old in first grade. And of course, I was ridiculed for it. And it took me 2 weeks to lose it. You know, yeah. It's the great thing about being very little is you can get rid of these embarrassing things.
You lost the
things.
Accent and picked up baseball. Huh?
Picked up baseball quickly to make myself a real American. And and that was so. I grew up in the 60s
in
New York.
What was it like in your house? Were there frequent discussions, salons, that kind of thing?
Yeah, they were part of the New York intellectual world, and I met people who I later realized were sort of famous people.
Like who?
Lionel Trilling, the great literary critic who taught at Columbia, Hannah Arendt, the political philosopher. They were all friends. Alan Bloom, who ended up here in Chicago,
yeah,
became very
famously,
famous.
Yeah.
And, but I, of course, was whatever I was, 10 or 12 or 14 years old, and you know, I knew a little bit about who they were, and I was sort of interested in some of what they might have written, but I wasn't that precocious, honestly. So I was mostly focused, as I say, on sports.
Was politics frequent topic?
Yes, though one forgets back then how much New York, how separate New York was from Washington. You know, I once talked to my father, I think, once told me he didn't know any congressman, any senator. He came to Washington a couple of times as a tourist, honestly. Never came to Washington. We, growing up, went once or twice to see the monuments. He knew Pat Moynihan well. It was one of the first people he knew who actually.
And you worked on one of his campaigns.
So Moynihan and Kennedy Johnson had a not very high level assistant secretary of labor, but some position, and then got well known. And so that was one of the first people I think my parents knew who was in government. And then he left in 65. But I think my father said once when he was called to some meeting in the Nixon White House, maybe in about 70, you know, one of these, let's have 12 people over for an hour and talk big ideas, kind of, I don't know. But I think it may have been the first time he'd been in the White House. So the separation of New York and Washington was much greater than it was later. There were, you know, and so people think that, so growing up, we talked politics and ideas a lot, but I was not like an intimate follower of who was doing what in the Republican caucus and the
And
the
did
Senate.
You have a, did you, did, how did your philosophy
so I was,
emerge?
I was sort of, I was always contrarian. And I read, of course, I was influenced by my parents, Public Interest, the magazine my father started in 65. I read Commentary magazine, which was on the left, and then moved to the right. But actually, I read National Review, which came home to our house. I think Bill Buckley gave my parents a complimentary
subscription. Did you know Buckley?
I knew him, got to know him later, mm-hmm. but not as a kid. I met him once or twice. And I was very sort of charmed by Buckley, and just he tapped into a certain contrarian streak in me. And I would say in the 60s, I saw many of my classmates and teachers, for that matter, at Collegiate, the private school I went to in New York, were, you know, left, new left, fashionably left, whatever you want to say. And I guess I rebelled against them rather than against my parents, I say. And so I probably moved a little bit to the right of my parents, even in the sense of being a critic of the new left and hostile to the new left. And at that point, I was, as I say, a Humphrey Jackson Democrat. In 72, my first election, I voted in. On the other hand, I was for Jackson. I worked hard for Scoop in Massachusetts. You know, all I did is hand out leaflets and stuff. I had a very low-level volunteer job, but it was the beginning of my successful political career, I believe, in 72. The Massachusetts primary was kind of important back then. It was earlier.
Yes.
After New Hampshire. Do you remember this? And I think, we all thought Scoop had a chance. McGovern had upset Muskie in New Hampshire, so it was a wide-open race. And surely McGovern wasn't going to be the nominee. That would be ridiculous. And so we thought Scoop had a chance. And Scoop ran seventh in the Massachusetts primary behind Wilbur Mills. And, so that was the beginning of my successful electoral career, which has just gone from one height to another over the last 40 years.
We had Carl Bernstein on here a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things that he said was that little noted in the about the 72 race was that the Nixon team were doing everything they could to help McGovern because they thought he'd be the easiest candidate to beat. Jackson was a principal feature of his candidacy was anti-communism. Was that what attracted you to him?
Yeah, and he was to the right of Nixon and Kissinger in some way, a critic of détente, a defender of human rights and of sort of, let's call it morality, somewhat in foreign policy, you know, not simply making deals with dictators. And Nixon was more of a, let's make a deal with the Soviets. Maybe in retrospect, that was a intelligence strategy. Maybe he took it too far. But I was sort of more on the, shouldn't we be standing up to the communist side of things? Anyway, but during all this time, honestly, I was in high school, then I was in college. I was studying political philosophy. I wasn't terribly involved politically. In 76, when I was halfway through grad school, but again, it was more in political philosophy than practical political things, I did take a summer off to work for Pat Moynihan, who was a good friend of my parents. And when he ran for the Democratic nomination for Senate in New York, and he beat Bella Abzug by 9,000 votes out of 2 million. So it was a surprisingly very close race. People forget how often, you know this very, very well, how often these big political careers begin with a, you know, very close result, right?
It's now, Bella never made that journey from left to right.
Yes, now Bella was solidly on the left. One of the things I did, this is pre-internet, pre-everything, is go to the New York Public Library and go to the microfiche, I think it was, and look up things she had done in the 40s and 50s, which were genuinely, let's say, fellow traveler defense. She went to Prague to defend, you know, the communist regime there in 51. And I think we managed to release some of that stuff, and maybe it made the difference. I don't know. So,
or else maybe it made it close. You never know.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. So anyway, I did my little bit to help Pat Moynihan become it. He then beat Jim Buckley. I stayed out of the general elections. I rather liked Jim Buckley, the incumbent who had won in that amazing three-way race in 1970. I'd volunteered in that for about 3 days, just, you know, wandering because I knew someone who was working for him. So I was sort of vaguely involved in politics, but honestly, my own personal interest was much more political philosophy, and I thought I would become an academic. And I did for a few years at Penn and then at Harvard, and then, like so many people, came to Washington. Bill Bennett became Reagan's education secretary at the beginning of the second term in 85, called me up and said, hey, come to Washington for a year, be a special assistant, write speeches, that kind of stuff. And like so many people, I came to Washington for a year, and 30 years later, I'm still there.
How we'll return to the things that attracted you to Scoop Jackson in the context of today's administration and today's politics. But how'd you come to know Bill Bennett? He was kind of a Yale guy. You were a Harvard guy, right?
What was it? He was Williams, I think, and then Harvard. I knew him sort of slightly randomly from, I don't know, I guess you'd say conservative-ish sort of academic enterprises. He was involved in that a little in the late 70s. He knew my parents a little bit, kind of mutual friends. I guess, but this is actually funny. So this is a little like you, I think, the transition from journalism, in my case, the academy to politics. The reason I got to know him was in the summer of 80, so at the Kennedy School. I teach political philosophy at Penn. They recruit me to go to the Kennedy School, where I'm going to teach political philosophy for public policy students. It turned out to be probably not a great idea, but it was very nice to me. It was a pleasant place to be for a couple of years. Summer of 84, they say, I think at the Kennedy School, someone says, why don't you go, you know, it's the Reagan administration. I was pro-Reagan. See what they're, maybe there's an interesting article to be written about sort of how they're doing. I don't know who's doing well, who's not doing well. So I went to Washington for about just to do a bunch of interviews, really, in 84, a few stretches of, you know, several days. I didn't move there or anything. And I did a piece, which I suppose someone could find if they wanted to, today on, I think it was three, the thesis was there's a middle ground between being a bonk thrower who blows oneself up, and Reagan had some of those in his first term and don't effectively change anything, and being someone who just accommodates to the bureaucracy and to the permanent government and doesn't make change, which a lot of the conservatives were accusing parts of the Reagan administration of being. And my thesis was you could do both. I mean, you could be an intelligent, you know, change agent, as we say today, and not blow yourself up, cause trouble, make real changes, et cetera. And so I found three people I thought were success stories in that respect. One was Jim Miller, who later became OMB director, but was then, I think, FTC head, a kind of a deregulator, free market type. The second, I'm now blanking on who it was even. And the third was Bill Bennett, who had been head of the National Endowment for the Humanities. So these were all people running pretty small, you know, second-tier agencies.
But doing interesting things from a conservative
from a conservative point of view, and doing them successfully so that actually making changes, not just complaining about the bureaucracy or about the media and stuff. And so I wrote one article that said, look, here's how they figured out how to work with and through the bureaucracy, not just to scream and yell at it. Here's how they figured out how to work. Bennett was pretty good at working the media, though the media
didn't
agree with him.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, he was a pretty flamboyant conservative.
Yes, but also managed to avoid, you know, to say, scandals and blowing himself up and so forth. So I wrote that piece, and that's when I spent some time with Bennett. and we got to know each other. And then 6 months later, when he got promoted to education secretary, he said, well, you're interested in practical politics, why don't you? And the Kennedy School encourages that kind of thing. So why don't you come to Washington? So that's when we first came.
It's funny how those stories go. There was a guy in a town here who just passed away, Jack Fuller, who was the editor and then publisher of the Chicago Tribune. When Jack was a young reporter, he had gone to Yale Law School. He'd come from a journalistic family, went to Yale Law School, and then came back and worked at the City News Bureau, got a job at the Tribune. And Edward Levy was appointed Attorney General, the president of the University of Chicago, in the middle of the Watergate, in the wake of the Watergate crisis, to try and restore the integrity of the Justice Department. Fuller was assigned to go down and talk to him and write a profile of him. And Levy read the profile and asked him to come to Washington with him based on that conversation and that profile. And so these are the things that change lives, these kinds of conversations.
I always tell young people that, you know, especially these days, you know, they try to plan their careers, and people do that a lot more than I think we did in our generation. And sometimes it's a wise thing to do. And some professions you do that. I mean, obviously law, medicine, you know, they're much more of a sort of set career path. And if you want to become an orthopedic surgeon, you have to do A, B, C. You can't just sort of whiff into that, you know.
One hopes.
Yes. Maybe, right.
I don't know how far this deregulation will go, but I'm hoping that continues to be the case.
Good point. But in our kinds of things, you do sort of move horizontally and somewhat randomly, yeah, right? And I think I personally like that aspect of Washington and that aspect of politics. But so I always tell young people, you know, what should I do if I want to become a political person? You know, there are a million things you could do. And the main thing is to find a good boss. I think that's extremely important when you learn a lot. Find a good boss who will hopefully be successful and bring you with him, and also from whom you'll learn and whom you'll enjoy working for. But don't overthink. Anyway, my big picture on these things is don't overplan your career, and basically do what you like doing and try to do it well, and keep your eyes open for opportunities, obviously. But a lot of it is very unpredictable, as you know.
Well, it's a real privilege to be able to follow your passion and make a living doing it.
Absolutely.
And we were lucky. It's always
you
a revelation to me. Absolutely.
And,
it's
know,
a revelation
people,
to
right.
me that you hear all – you're a baseball fan. You hear these ball players saying, I can't believe I get – paid to now. I actually can't believe what they do get paid to do it now, but it's fun to it's great if you can pursue your passion and find even if it's, you know, you may find at the beginning it's not very remunerative, but it makes for a happier life.
And the other thing I found, at least, is I think it helped me somewhat in Washington. I was behind a lot of people. I hadn't worked on the Hill. I came to Washington when I was 32, 33. And, you know, a lot of people get there when they're 21 and, you know, get to work, networking and building their resume and all that. But I think it helped me that I had studied political philosophy and history. Even a lot of it wasn't terribly relevant in any direct way. Taught for a few years, which you get a certain kind of skills doing that. And so I encourage undergraduates in particular, you know, study what you want to study and study something important, and don't necessarily feel that every summer you have to be an intern somewhere or something. And if you want to learn, if you like classical literature, learn Greek and study it for 2 or 3 years. It won't hurt you, and it might help you a lot. And I think a lot of people our age who've done pretty well in journalism or government or whatever, they didn't, you know, start off as, you know, incredibly hardworking, you know, gophers on the Hill at age 19, right?
Yeah.
They had a lot of other interests, you know.
Yeah.
Charles Krauthammer went to medical school, and George Will went to graduate school in political philosophy. Just thinking of the people I know.
Another great baseball fan.
And a huge,
great Cubs fan.
And a great Cubs fan.
Yeah. The, no, I think, you know, if
you... So be a baseball fan. That is the message,
that's the
right?
Key.
That's obviously
that's the key here. The, no, I think being a great generalist, being someone with kind of broad intellectual curiosity, is to me the key to being a good journalist. And in a sense, it's also the key to being a good office holder and a good policymaker. So I agree with you there. Talk about Reagan. You arrived there in the age of Reagan. Reagan's name gets invoked a lot now, you know, and I think sometimes it gets invoked without real understanding of who he was and what he represented. You know, people, I'm on CNN a lot. My colleague Jeffrey Lord, who worked for Reagan, likes to invoke Reagan all the time in defense of Donald Trump. But that's a big gap. That's a big leap.
Well, it is a big leap. I mean, just in the very simple, commonsensical way. Reagan was a guy who benefited from being a minor celebrity, not like Trump, actually less of one than Trump. But then spent 10 years, you know, educating himself on conservative thought. It turns out he read a lot of books and articles and gave speeches. Then became governor of California, not a trivial thing, for 8 years. Mm-hmm. Ran for president in a primary and lost, and then became president. He had a lot of actual governing experience and a deep understanding of a certain ideology. Maybe that was limited, and people can criticize the ideology, but he really had a basis, a theory that informed his governing, a theory of foreign policy with respect to the Soviet Union, a theory about free markets, a theory about a lot of things, Constitution and the Supreme Court. Trump really has none of that. So I think both in personal character, but also just in sort of groundedness, Reagan is really one of our more grounded presidents when he came to office, not unlike President Obama in the sense that he had spent a lot of time, agree or disagree, thinking about what he thought was wrong or deficient about the current situation, how things needed to be fixed.
Yeah.
For my generation of conservatives, Reagan was so big just because conservatism had been a protest movement, you know, either a gadfly-type protest movement, Bill Buckley running for mayor of New York in 65. Goldwater Luth getting crushed in 64. That was a little before my time in terms of being involved, but I'm not sure I would have been for Goldwater against Johnson, honestly. But and then in the 70s, of course, Nixon, you know, sort of a conservative, but sort of a operative, you might say, and blows up in any case, and it looks kind of hopeless. So that when Reagan won in 80, the sort of surprise and the opportunity was amazing. And then that he governed successfully. I mean, again, people can agree or disagree, but reelected, his vice president gets elected. We win the Cold War by the end of that decade, pretty good economic performance. I mean, that was just a huge deal. People now take it, well, of course, there was the Reagan era and that went okay. And then but that had to be corrected by Clinton or whatever people want to say. But of course, it wasn't obvious that it was going to go okay. People thought it might just be a fiasco and chaos.
And there were elements of that, of course. But there was, when Reagan got elected, a lot of the apprehension. I mean, he was a big agent of change. I mean, he was the line of demarcation between New Deal liberalism and the next epic right. in our history, and there was a lot of concern about that. He represented big change, but as you say, change that he had thought through. It came with a respect for sort of institutions and history. So it seems to me distinguished him from what we have today. But in honor of President Reagan and free markets, we're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsor. I'll be right back with Bill Kristol. You talked about that piece that you wrote that led to your relationship with Bill Bennett. Just on Reagan one more minute. It seemed to me that he showed a pragmatism that was consistent with his conservatism, but Reagan's big the philosophy that people always share of governance was, if I can get 80% of what I want, I'll go for that. And he made deals and he made compromises, compromises that I'm not sure would be accepted today by some who consider themselves conservatives, but in this sort of populist movement within the Republican Party, within the evangelical movement, and so on. How would Reagan have fared in today's political climate if he approached politics the way he did?
I think
skilled guy.
So skilled, it's hard to say. Maybe he could have educated people too. I mean, I say he campaigned for the sake of governing. I mean, he wanted to govern the country, and he wanted to change things. And that's pretty different from some politicians today who campaign for the sake of making a statement and who then get in office and just think all they're supposed to do is keep making statements. Trump's case is both less ideological than Reagan and less interested in governing, which is sort of a weird combination, you know. But people, when Trump won, I had some friends who were much more pro-Trump, obviously, than I was, and they were so excited. You know, this is comparable to the Reagan Revolution, one of them told me. And I said, look, the Reagan Revolution was not winning in 1980. That was important and necessary and, impressive. The Reagan Revolution was governing for 8 years and maybe 12, if you give him some credit for Vice President Bush, and what he did in those years. And again, people can agree or disagree with what he did, but that was the accomplishment. And I do think Trump really thinks, you see this so much when he's now governing, but he still thinks he's campaigning.
Well, in fact,
and I'm very struck by that psychologically,
He called some of his supporters, I think, to signify that he's still, the man. He called some of his supporters over to the White House today, congressional supporters who had been early supporters of his, and talked to them as serially about how he did in their districts, you know, and there is this sense that winning the election was sort of the goal.
Right.
It's sort of a weird kind of bizarro world, a version of the candidate where at the end of the movie, Robert Redford gets elected and says, what do we do now?
Yeah, I don't recall Reagan talking much about the 80 election once it was over. And it doesn't mean you have to, you shouldn't forget about it. He rewarded supporters and, you know, preferred them to people who hadn't supported him. Well, that's normal politics, obviously. He also reached out, however, and his chief of staff, Jim Baker, had been, of course, Bush's campaign chairman. That's a pretty amazing, unusual fact, I would say, and shows something about that Reagan understood about governing. But the Trump thing is really, just recently he tweeted, tweets everything all the time, but it was one of his attacks on the intelligence community. And it was something like, you know, the terrible FBI and NSA, I think it was, are leaking illegally leaking, and that has to stop. And he really thought, has he not thought for a minute that he is president of the United States? If he thinks there's illegal leaking going on from the FBI, which is supervised by the Justice Department, which is supervised by an attorney general he just appointed, Jeff Sessions, or the NSA, which is supported, I suppose, supervised by the Director of National Intelligence, and Dan Coats, another appointee of his who's about to be confirmed next week, I think.
And probably wondering whether he did the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, if he thinks there's illegal leaking going on, if he's president, he should do something about it. He should say this. Yeah. But he doesn't even think. This is what really I find sort of jolting about Trump. He doesn't even think as president. He somehow never internalized. You were there with President Obama, and I'd be curious to know what you think. I mean, how this happened for him, but in 08, 09. But he has not internalized the fact that he is now president of the United States. And he has to think differently than if you're running for president or even in a transition, sort of jockeying a little bit with the current administration about when you're going to take over and how. He's president. And I'm really shocked by the degree to which he and the people around him, I would say, incidentally, haven't internalized that. I came into the White House. I was domestic policy advisor to Dan Quayle, and then chief of staff after a few months. That. So it was much, not at the highest. I mean, chief of staff was senior staff, obviously, assistant to the president, but still not in the highest levels. But still, the degree to which it was hammered into us that you are now in the White House. You are not on a campaign. You are not in a business. You are not having fun as a professor, popping off on things. You've got to be careful in what you say, both for ethics reasons, but also just because people might interpret what you say as the policy of the country. I remember being told, you go to parties, picnic with your friends here in Washington, you know, you'll go to some dinner or something. And not that you shouldn't have a free, fun conversation at all, but you do need to be careful. You can't repeat things that were said here. You never know what's going to be taken out of context and publicized. And this is before social media, incidentally, so it's much worse today. And I remember taking that pretty seriously. I didn't. And the idea that you just kind of wander out Kellyanne Conway or something and give interviews every 3 hours on cable news, and if Ivanka Trump's being attacked, you're going to, you know, and I don't really blame her for this in some serious way, I guess, jokingly defend her line of clothing. But I mean, it is inappropriate.
Yeah.
And if you have internalized the notion that you are now working in the White House, not on a campaign and not for the Trump organization, you wouldn't do that. You know?
Yeah, except
and nothing
for that.
Clicks, except, nothing clicks in their head, I
well,
think.
Well, everything flows from the top in a White House. You worked in an administration, in the administration of George H.W. Bush. He had been a congressman. He had been ambassador to China, ambassador to the UN, head of the CIA, and vice president, and chairman, by the way, of the Republican National Committee. There may not have been anybody ever elected president who had more institutional experience than he did, and obviously a very high regard for it. And he was the son of a senator. So he was steeped in institutional history and had a regard for it. And I'm sure that that was something that he insisted on among all the people who worked for him. My notion on Kellyanne's infomercial for Ivanka's clothing line was that she was speaking to an audience of one. And for Donald Trump, I'm sure he found that very appealing that she would take up the cudgel for his daughter. So, you know, the man at the top or the woman at the top, someday there will be, sets the tone for a White House. And I think this White House so far reflects Donald Trump. And, you know, you're talking about a guy who quite different from George H.W. Bush, Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, and others, has absolutely no grounding in government. And one of the reasons he was elected, Bill, was because people wanted that. They wanted someone who would blow it all up and kick Washington in the ass. And he said, I would do that. The problem is you also have to make the thing run.
And be responsible and accountable to the public, which is not something you have to do if you're running a private business or even running a campaign in some ways, though there are FEC rules and stuff, but still it's very different from being in the White House. Yeah, no, he's leaving aside one's judgment about him as a true, just analytical matter, he's the first, obviously, non-elected official since Eisenhower to win a nomination, let alone become president. Eisenhower's general of the army. So the first one.
Saved democracy.
And Hoover had been a cabinet secretary. So you really, in modern times, there's never been anyone, well, never in American history has there been anyone who became president prior to Trump who hadn't had either elective
military
office
or military
or cabinet, I guess. And so that is a huge deal. It doesn't mean it shouldn't happen, it should never happen. It doesn't mean that in this case necessarily it was the wrong judgment by people. But again, the premise would then have to be, I mean, it seems to me if I were, I don't know, became head of General Motors, something I know nothing about. I've never really worked in the private sector in any big way except universities, but not in the for-profit sector in a big way. Don't know anything about the auto industry and et cetera. Don't know much about General Motors itself as an organization. Excuse me, if I was suddenly magically became CEO of General Motors, I would spend quite a lot of time learning about General Motors, learning about how things had gone in the past. I might want to change a lot of things, but how much more so for the presidency of the United States? But Trump seems not to have really thought about that. He seems to think he kind of knows what he wants to do.
I don't think he actually expected to be elected.
Well,
I really don't think he did. I think this was an exercise in branding. And he overshot the runway. And I think he delighted in winning. But I don't think he contemplated much the implications of it. And that's one of the reasons, you know, you people will say, and you might, that Democrats are throwing sand in the machine here to try and slow down his appointments, but they've come slowly. They've come without the proper vetting, and I think that's in part a reflection of lack of planning that reflects this notion that he wasn't going to win.
Yeah, I have no problem with the Democrats opposing his appointees and slowing down things to some degree. I think the main criticism I would have of the left, not that they really ask for my criticism or advice, is they're a little bit...
No, but they expect it.
That's a good point. And they respect it in a certain... they won't admit it, of course, but they welcome it because they know it. I, in my heart, I'm doing my best for them. They should be a little more discriminate, I'd say. And I mean, there's a little way in which constant hysteria is a problem as you lose the forest for the trees and you lose the kind of really...
No, I don't disagree
really
with
big
that.
Problems
I mean, they did, the little ones.
I mean, he can do something stylistically that's annoying, and I don't like it either. That's very different from, you know, endangering our foreign policy or really inappropriately doing things in the White House and so forth.
Yes. Well, I mean, the fact is that some of the president's nominations passed rather swiftly.
Right.
General Mattis's appointment as defense secretary. Even Tillerson had more problem, it seemed, from the Republicans, from Marco right. Rubio in particular, than Democrats. General Kelly. And I think partly... Democrats found it reassuring that these people of solidity were going to fill these positions, even if they didn't necessarily agree with them on a bunch of things. Before, I don't want to lose the thread of your life, though, because you worked for a vice president who was sometimes the object of derision, Dan Quayle, and. Tell me about that experience. I know that you were in the middle of a really important battle, the one with Murphy Brown, when you were
in '92. Yes, that's kind of faded into the mist of. So I joined. I mean, I had been Bennett's chief. I'd come to work for Bennett, became his chief of staff because the chief of staff moved over to be general counsel. I did that for a couple of 2.5 years. Ran a hopeless Senate campaign in '88 in Maryland. against Sarbanes, who was a totally safe incumbent. But I learned a lot from that. That's another thing, if we're just talking about biography. I was not a campaign guy, really. I'd been the issues, deputy issues director for Moynihan, as I said, in 76. That wasn't really the mechanics of a campaign. I learned a huge amount having to run a campaign, and it was a kind of hopeless one and a pretty ineffectual one. We got the same vote that everyone got against Sarbanes, 38-39% in Maryland. Bush won Maryland, though, in 88, so that's kind of amazing how much the electoral map has changed, right?
Yes.
In a quarter century. So we didn't drag him down, at least. But I did that. So then
this
I was
for Alan Keyes?
Yes, Alan Keyes, my roommate from grad school, so who has since gone a little bit off the rails. But
he came out here for about 6 months and tried
to
get
elected
to the Senate.
Yes, he helped you guys. He helped President Obama. So he has a kind of zealot-like character showing up at these big moments, right?
Nobody got under Barack Obama's skin more than Alan Keyes.
In that debate, right? Yeah.
Well, in the debates, I mean, they were, shall we say, vituperative. Yeah. But also, he almost had a fist fight on the street with Alan Keyes. And you know, as you know, this President Obama was pretty slow to anger. But boy, Keyes just...
Well, he's very smart. He's a good speaker. He'd gone a little... So got much more extreme. I mean, in 88, he was regarded as a rising star in the Republican Party. They recruited him to run in Maryland. He had been a Gene Kirkpatrick protege at the State Department. He'd been assistant secretary of state. I mean, he'd had a responsible job in the government. And I thought it would be fun because we'd do our best. We would lose. He was recruited late. The original candidate, I can't remember who it was, dropped out. I think he was ill or something. And so it was kind of a hopeless thing anyway. And it was a Democratic state. And Sarbanes was a very popular incumbent. But I thought it would be good for Alan. Maybe he'd get a job in the next administration and, you know, run in the future. And I'd learn something. And we did our best. I would do our best. So I actually left the Reagan administration, took a huge pay cut. Not that it was so big in the first place, being in government, to almost on a volunteer basis run this campaign for 4 or 5 months. And I learned a ton. I do tell young people, you really learn a lot having to go through a campaign. It's like real government. You can talk yourself into government. I'm doing great. We're making a difference. Who knows who's really making a difference? You know, campaign. There's like a real date where you see what happens, right? And so there's a real judgment that there isn't in a lot of the rest of our public life.
It also it infuses them with a real sense of urgency that is energizing.
Right. And then you deal with the public and you realize it's much more – the public's impression and understanding of politics is somewhat different from what you might think sitting around at Penn or Harvard and stuff. So,
or even in Washington.
Or especially maybe in Washington. So it was a great experience for me, and I respect Alan. I'm sorry he sort of went down the path he did. But yes, 2004 was his – that was his great – I knew he would annoy – President Obama, though, or then I guess State Senator Obama, just because, Alan is, and I think Obama says this in his memoir that he sort of like his advisors urged him to kind of just ignore. I mean, he's going to win by 50 points. What was the point? You
know? Right.
So just ignore Keyes, but he just got so annoyed at him at the debate that he kind of lashed out and made it more of a story than it would have been. I think is that right?
I remember
right?
so clearly watching the news one night, and they were covering. I think it was some Hispanic parade, and there's footage of Barack Obama jabbing his finger into Alan Keyes' chest and essentially menacing him. And I call him and I said, you know, what the hell is this? I said, you know, we're up by 50. I said, what are you doing? He said, I just can't help it, man. That guy gets under my skin. He just really...
Well, if anyone's listening to this, this will be gratifying to him, I guess. But anyway, it did not derail Barack Obama's political career.
He ended up winning by about that much. So that was enough.
Yes,
that was enough.
Exactly. So I worked for Quayle, and then I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I actually was talking to one or two universities about coming back to teaching and thinking I may be a think tank kind of thing. And I got a couple of inquiries. I guess people had heard of, you know, they knew of me a little bit. I'd worked for Bennett, you know, chief of staff at a second-tier agency, but still, Bennett was well-regarded. And Dan Quayle called me, whom I knew very slightly. He'd been on the Education Committee in the Senate, so Bennett had testified before, and we'd worked a little on a couple of things together. And would I be interested in coming over and being his domestic policy advisor? And we met, and we got along, and I said yes. So I came to the White House as domestic policy advisor to the vice president, became his chief of staff about 5 months later, because the gentleman who started off that way was really had been hired. It turned out I didn't realize this kind of to manage the trend, help Quayle get going. He was an older guy, you know, sort of new Washington, get it stabilized. And then after this pretty disastrous campaign Quayle had had in 88, and then I took over as chief of staff. So I was chief of staff to Quayle for 3.5 years. It was a great privilege and honor, as you know, to work in the White House. And it was exciting. It was a very mixed ride. I'm proud to have been part of that administration. We, of course, got clobbered in 92. As I say, part of my successful political career, I signed on to an administration that had won with 54% of the vote in 1988. And by the time I was through in 1992, Bush had 38% of the vote, one of the most rapid declines in American history. It's a little hard to, in retrospect, it's a good lesson about politics that, like, why exactly did people turn against Bush so much? He wasn't that bad a president, you know?
No, he was.
But somehow 12 years was a long time. And actually, the one thing that made me, I was wrong about a lot this past year, as many of us were, but I always thought Trump had a chance in the general election. And I used to say 1 in 3, 1 in 4 chance. And I worried I was not for either of them, but I would say sometimes I think the Clinton campaign is they need more of a positive message. They need somehow to explain that she will bring about change too. And the one thing I learned in 92 was the power of the sentiment of change. I mean, I don't think Bush did a bad job as president. The 12 years of Reagan-Bush had a lot of good things happen for America. But people wanted change. And the one thing I learned then is you can scream till you're blue in the face that Clinton has problems and that things are better than you think and that it's better to reward Bush for winning the Cold War than to say, thank you, you won the Cold War. Now we want to focus on health care and education. But nonetheless, if people are in that mood, they will vote for change. And I think that was really true. And
things are better than you think is not a very good approach.
It is a terrible, it's maybe true, but it's a bad approach. And I do think that in 2016, Trump benefited so much from being against Bush and then Clinton, the establishment, and from being the guy who promised change in a change environment.
That came screaming through in the exit polls. I mean, the one dimension that he dominated was we'll bring change to Washington. And that was among the various qualities that people were offered in the exit poll. That was the quality that they most were looking for. I think he was in the 80s in that particular quality. We're going to take another short break, and we'll be back with Bill Kristol. One more question on Quayle, and I know you weren't on board during the campaign,
no.
Right, Nate? Yeah, but his whole career was really defined by one moment in one debate when Lloyd Benson ridiculed him for suggesting that he had more experience than John F. Kennedy did when John F. Kennedy became president, because the question about Quayle was he kind of callow and shallow and ill-prepared to be one heartbeat away from the presidency. Did he ever recover from that moment? It always gets replayed. Every 4 years when you see election debate coverage, they say, well, this is what you want to avoid, a moment like this.
Right. I mean, I think he had been wounded already by the rollout, which was not done well. I don't think the Bush people did him a favor. Bush personally kept the choice of Quayle from his top advisors. He wanted to surprise them. There's a lot of psychological stuff going on at that point, I think, of who's in charge, and I'm not just going to let Jim Baker tell me that it should be Bob Dole or Pete DiMedici or some sort of more established person. I'm going to go young. And I think Ailes and Teeter were for that. There was, after 8 years of Reagan, you wanted a new generation. Quayle was a very successful politician. Quayle had defeated a Democrat in 76 for the House, an incumbent, and then Birch Bayh, the incumbent Democrat for the Senate in 80, and won the biggest election margin ever, I think, for any Senate race, maybe any race,
in
86, Indiana.
People
forget, I mean, this was a guy picked in 88 as young, up-and-coming, won in Indiana, not a safe Republican state, a lot of labor votes for Quayle. He had worked with Ted Kennedy on an education and labor bill in the early 80s, but a hawk on foreign policy. And the launch was bad, the debate thing was disastrous, and he certainly didn't recover during the campaign, and I probably didn't do a very good job, as good a job as I should have, of helping him recover as vice president. It's hard to recover as vice president. The thing I took from this is, if you're a governor, you can have a very rocky start. You're still governor, and you can do things, and 3 years later, you can say, okay, look, I had a rocky start, but let's look at the unemployment numbers. Let's look at what I did here in this area. Well, let's look at what I did in that area. If you're a senator, you can have a rocky start. Ooh, I kind of screwed up, but look here, I passed this legislation 2 years later. You can change your image. Bill Bennett had a very rocky start at education secretary in 85, kind of popped off on a couple of things and got beat up in the papers and stuff. Even there, he was able to spend 3 years being a reformer and giving more serious speeches and putting out some publications and documents. We didn't have much legislative success in the second term of Reagan, but he left as a respected guy. With vice president, it's so hard.
Yeah, what do you do?
What do you do? And we probably, maybe we weren't imaginative enough. There was no, of course, internet then, no social media. And so also you were sort of confined to working through the established media, which was not terribly friendly to him. He made a couple of mistakes as vice president. They got magnified. It's a good lesson. You've been through this a million times. I mean, of the once you have an image, you know, it's hard to shake the image. And anything you do that fits into the image
right,
just deepens it and reaffirms it. And so once every 9 months, Dan Quayle would make a gaffe. I believe in most politicians make a gaffe every 9 months, right? But if they think, you know, bright guy, okay, fine, he made a gaffe once. If you're the guy who's was defined by the Dukakis, by the Benson moment, then every 9 months that gaffe becomes the only news about you for a couple of
years. Well, Gerry Ford was another example of that. You know, he was an all-American athlete, and he stumbled, I guess, coming off a platform or something, and that became, or maybe he didn't, but Chevy Chase sort of parodied him, and this notion of this bumbler sort of took hold and hurt him. You know, a guy who was really quite experienced and accomplished in politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think we fixed it a little. I mean, Quayle did well in the debate with Gore in 92, very much held his own. Probably even, I'd say, won it kind of narrowly. I think Gore was playing safe because Clinton was ahead and they didn't want to sort of make news out of the vice presidential debate. But Quayle was pretty aggressive and pretty effective. The Murphy Brown speech, which people now remember
laughingly, about that.
Was actually...
Did you write that speech?
I helped with it. Actually, we had a couple other people work on it. Quayle worked on it a lot himself. It's a serious speech about family breakup. Probably it was a mistake. I wouldn't have gotten all the attention if we hadn't used the TV show and the fact that she was having a child out of wedlock as the kind of hook. But of course, it also going to California and giving that speech when Hollywood is all excited about Clinton and hostile to Bush and Quayle was probably... It was a double-edged sword. I think it
got a lot of attention.
It got a lot of attention. And you know what? It's interesting. I think you can see this, and Clinton discusses this maybe, or this is discussed in the accounts of the Clinton campaign. The Democrats wanted to ridicule Quayle. That's what they did naturally. You know, that came easy to them. Clinton, who's a very smart political character and was trying to be a centrist, was kind of a centrist Democrat, did not let his staff ridicule Quayle and gave a speech about a week later in which he said, look, we all know that Dan Quayle is just, you know, don't take him seriously. But you know what? In this speech, there are a few things that we do need to be worried about, and we do need to be worried about family structure. So Clinton saw that Quayle was onto something, and he didn't want the Democrats to be the party that just ridiculed any concern about kids growing up with one parent rather than two and about family breakup and structure and so forth. So Quayle was onto something there. But then we had this ridiculous thing with the spelling which again, I take responsibility. I mean, I was the chief of staff. I was on that trip. You've been on these things a million times.
For those who don't know, he had a confrontation with a young
with a
woman
sixth grader
in the spelling bee.
So he walks into.
Had misspelled the word potato.
So no good deed goes unpunished. Right? He goes to New York, gives a good speech, goes across the river to New Jersey to visit a school, a predominantly lower income Hispanic school, which is part of a program. I think the Justice Department was running it with others and local people to help kids in schools that are, you know, obviously that are struggling. It was a totally good program, bipartisan and all that kind of stuff. It was a kind of just a feel-good thing would be one way of saying it, but it was an appropriate, I'd say the other way to say it was an appropriate recognition of people. Parents were volunteering there. I think we went in late, it was a long day and he was tired. Late in the afternoon, the parents were volunteering. I think it was one of these things where they were trying to get these parents to volunteer at the school and therefore help the kids learn English better and so forth. And we were walking in, and it was, you've been in these things again a million times, and the little briefing beforehand said, well, the teacher's having a little spelling bee, so you want to just participate for 5 minutes. It'd be a nice photo op. It'd be funny with the kids. And I remember saying something like, well, is this all like work? The vice president's a little tired. I mean, this is all like done, right? I mean, this is on, you know, scripted, so to speak. You know, oh yeah, no problem. And indeed, this little kid comes up, and the teacher calls him up, and the vice president's standing with the teacher and spell potato, and he spells potato. And as Quayle told me afterwards, he said he looked at it, he thought it looked right to him, but he looked down at the card they had given him, and the card they had given him was POTATOE. And he said, gee, I think you're missing an E there, son. Because he looked at the card. And of course, and this was, I mean, this was our, probably our fault that we spent, of course, then of course, everything exploded. And by the time we got out the story that he had been given this card by some person at the school who just made a mistake, presumably, you know, it was like too late. And it fit into the narrative. That's the other thing. So that was about a week before the Democratic Convention, I think.
Yeah.
And so, of course, they had fun at the Democratic Convention with spelling jokes and stuff. And I guess, the vice president never quite recovered. Though, on the other hand, honestly, he had a good campaign in 92. And I mean, Bush, he had a horrible campaign in 88, and Bush won by 9 points, I think. He had a good debate with Gore in 92, and we lost by, what, 6 points?
Which tells you how much your VP means.
Totally. I've always been, yes. Whenever people say vice presidential pick, I always say, I don't know. You know, maybe it matters sometimes.
Well, it may have mattered. I don't think it would have changed the outcome. It obviously mattered for McCain. You were a big proponent of Sarah Palin, though, right?
I was a proponent of taking Lieberman, and then they decided they couldn't do that. So I was for the bipartisan, going for the...
I think that hurt him.
And that he didn't do but Lieberman.
Well, that would have been an interesting move. He couldn't apparently get him through the convention.
His advisors thought they couldn't get him through the convention. I believe he could. What do I know? I thought he could, looking from the outside, and I thought it was worth it. Once he did that, I thought, well, you might as well take a gamble, because otherwise it's going to be pretty hopeless. And Palin was, again, a sort of respected governor. She had bipartisan support. She was kind of populist. I'd say in this way, the interest in Palin was a little ahead of the curve.
She was a forerunner of the Trump.
And a forerunner of the Tea Party. This is a pre-Tea Party. So in that respect, I had an instinct that you needed, after 8 years of Bush, something a little more that way. But did it matter, do you think, at the end? Probably hurt him a little
bit. Well, here's what I think. McCain's great strength was that he was sort of country first, that he would do the right thing for the country, regardless of politics. And when she stumbled and looked ill-prepared to be president, it looked as if he had made a political decision instead of putting the country first when he selected his VP. If he had chosen Lieberman, that would have been a different story, obviously.
That was a different kind of gamble. Yeah, I think I didn't expect, you know, honestly, I expected Palin to do better. I think she was a little Trump-like in the sense that she thought she'd gotten very far in politics on charm and some real natural gifts, person-to-person gifts and stuff, and being in sync with a lot of voters. And she thought you could make it through a presidential campaign just depending on those gifts. And she didn't work as hard as she might have. But you know, the one case I think the VP made a difference, and no one actually talks about this in terms of 2016, is I actually think Trump's pick of Pence probably was necessary. I mean, of course, in that close an election, everything makes a difference. But if you think about it, if one thinks about it, Pence helped reassure Republicans and conservatives who were very doubtful about Trump, and a lot of people I know personally were this way. It's like, you know what? Pence will be there. We'll get a good Supreme Court justice. It'll be less crazy. And, you know, we can sleep at night voting for Trump. I personally couldn't,
but they could.
And I think it didn't get him any new votes, but it sort of consolidated the 46%. I think the consolidation of the 46% would have been harder with maybe someone else. And weirdly, conversely, Tim Kaine, whom I like personally, and he's my senator, and I thought was a good pick at the time, I've got to say, I don't think helped Clinton.
I think it was ill-served, though. His debate performance
that was terrible.
Out of character.
And what was that about? That was the Clinton people telling him that
he was instructed to be aggressive, and he was completely out of character. The only times in that debate that he shone was when he was more reflective and in keeping with his own personality. So let me ask you this about Pence, though. I've never had a presidency where so many people come up to me and say, you think he'll serve his 4 years? I keep reminding people, this isn't a parliamentary system, okay? He's got a four-year term. But there is this lingering sense that for whatever reason, either through problems that he runs into, disinterest or something, and there is this narrative that Republicans on the Hill, they're going to milk Trump for what they can get, whether it's the Supreme Court justice, the tax cuts, deregulation, and so on. But if he gets in trouble, they're not going to stand by him because they'd just as soon have Pence.
I mean, I'm inclined to agree with what you said earlier, that that's a little too facile. It's not a parliamentary system. And how exactly does this impeachment thing work? You know, I mean, it's kind of a complicated process to go through. It's not like you can have a vote of no confidence and suddenly, you know, Margaret Thatcher's out and someone else is in. So I'm a little dubious. But I would say in general, a week before Trump was sworn in, among non-Trump enthusiastic enthusiast Republicans, there was a certain feeling of, you know, maybe this won't be so terrible. I mean, we can, he'll be a little goofy and we won't like a lot of the things he says. But, you know, you'll have an administration with Mattis and Tillerson and Price at HHS, who knows what he's doing, and other people, and hopefully Jared and others will keep it kind of a little less crazy. And there are ways to work around the problems, and you'll get some good things accomplished legislatively and in terms of Supreme Court justices. I do think now, what are we, just almost a month in, that that has flipped. And I think if you talk privately to Republicans on the Hill, it's like, oh my God, I mean, what is going on? Can we survive this for 4 years? What if the wheels just come off? We haven't really experienced that in modern American politics. Again, people have had road bumps and problems. Yeah, and
certainly a month in.
Yeah, a month in. And it does feel to me, it was not, I mean, the Nixon comparisons are overwrought, but honestly, it feels a little like Nixon 73. You know, a president in the White House flailing about, aides being fired, cabinet secretaries basically figuring out how are we going to sort of cushion the effect of our own president on our agency or on the world, right? And I do think the big thing there, I think the big mistake Republicans on the Hill made was this kind of, some of them, facile, and among conservative commentators even more, facile belief that, hey, Trump won, huge upset, very impressive, great momentum. Republicans held the Senate, somewhat of a surprise maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't lose too many House seats. So you know what? We're going to get all this stuff through. And I remember saying, even in the transition, even when Trump looked a little stronger, really, isn't it kind of hard to get stuff through Congress? I mean, Barack Obama had 59 and then 60 Democratic senators. Right. And it took you guys a year to get Obamacare through, and then, well, year and a quarter, really, to get it fully through. You got the stimulus. You got stopped on cap and trade. You didn't even try immigration. It was too complicated. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying that it is actually hard to govern.
Right.
It is hard to get big pieces of legislation through. The idea that Mitch McConnell, who is a good legislative tactician, can just snap his fingers and produce a tax bill.
Let's just say, when you've got the system is set up, it's easier to stop things than make things happen.
Totally. And you've got, you know, you got your Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, and you've got your Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, and you've got McCain and Lindsey Graham. It's not like they're all going to, for the last few weeks, it's been confirmations, and there they've mostly held the line. And I think there's a deep view, if the president of your party is nominating someone who's not just manifestly unqualified or unethical, you're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. So those will go through. And people are now overinterpreting that, I think, from the outside, and especially maybe on the left, where they really sort of think these Republicans on the Hill are kind of craven and cowardly, which they are to some degree, but that they're going to, the same thing's going to happen on taxes or on Obamacare repeal and replacement or on a million other legislative issues. And that is not the case. I mean, if you're elected to be a senator, a Republican senator, you think, you know what, Republican president, I'm going to vote 95% of the time for his cabinet appointees and sub-cabinet appointees. Legislation, I'm a senator. You know, if I represent Arkansas, I'm not voting for a border adjustment tax. It's going to increase prices for my constituents. And Walmart, incidentally, which is the biggest employer of the state, is very much against it. And you're not going to, because Donald Trump won an upset victory, you're suddenly going to change your views on a big issue like that. So I think his legislative agenda is in much more trouble than people think.
What about Russia? We talked about your roots with Scoop Jackson.
Right.
What is your read on this president's relationship with Russia and Putin? And how did you react to his interview with Bill O'Reilly on Super Bowl Sunday when he appeared to equate how the United States does its business with the way Vladimir Putin does his?
I think that comment about, you know, he's a killer, but we have killers.
Yeah,
to
you think,
we've
you
done
think
our killing.
So, to, we think our country's so innocent.
I think that hurt him more than any other thing before the Flynn maybe firing. Or the Flynn fracas among
good alliteration.
Among Republicans, yeah, on the Hill. I think that was like a bit of a. I noticed the people who had been bending over backwards to be kind of pro-Trump, or quiet about Trump. Liz Cheney, the new congresswoman from Wyoming, put out a statement or tweeted something about this is unacceptable. And I do think that was sort of crossing a line too far. Blame. I mean, Republicans have spent 30 years, you know, looking for opportunities to call the Democrats the Blame America First Party and attacking moral equivalence. And, you know, President Obama always wants to apologize for things that we've done and all this sort of thing. And then suddenly there he is saying something that's so far beyond anything President Obama ever said in criticizing the American government,
right,
until apparently – we recent, including very recent American governments, both parties. I mean, that I think was a huge, that was a big moment. On Russia, look, you don't even have to get into the questions of money and other things, which are legitimate questions, obviously, to say that just on his public statements, he is very, he's too much too warm towards Putin, credulous about Putin, I would say, and seems to lack the fundamental understanding. We can argue about how to implement, so to speak, this understanding, and there are differences between conservatives and liberals on this, between like democratic allies on the one hand and authoritarian opponents on the other. We can then have a debate about how to work with and also while checking the authoritarian opponents and the reset and this and that. Those are sort of policy issues. But I think both parties have had a general agreement that we prefer our allies to those who aren't our allies. We prefer liberal democracies to non-liberal democracies or non-liberal non-democracies. And that's kind of a guiding...
That has been the guiding philosophy of the U.S. It's not necessarily the guiding philosophy of everyone around Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, for example.
Right.
You know, it feels as if liberal democracies globally are sort of under assault and that there isn't necessarily... a unified view within the White House and the administration of support for them.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's one of the most worrisome things. And foreign policy, you know, if you mess up and really go off the rails and let your opponents strengthen themselves a lot, that's hard to fix. I mean, domestic policy, at the end of the day, if you have a bad tax plan, you can replace it with a better tax plan. You forego some economic growth or whatever in the meantime, and same with most aspects of domestic policy. Foreign policy, you can't sort of, if people lose confidence in the United States and decide to go nuclear, you're not going to unmake them nuclear, you know, even with a great successor. And that's one reason I was critical of some of President Obama's policies, but I'm equally critical and more critical, really, of Trump's. We don't really know what the policies are yet, but of the indications of some of his policies. And that's, for me, the foreign policy was always the kind of showstopper when it came to, well, gee, why aren't you supporting Trump, you know, because, yeah, I can imagine a fair number of judicial appointments that I like, a fair number of policies that I either like or think are kind of a close call. You know, I'm not hard, big, you know, one way or the other, the tax plan, I don't know, you know, it doesn't. But the foreign policy of a Trump administration was worrisome when he was running, was worrisome during the transition, got a little reassuring for about a week or two there with Mattis.
With his appointments. You wrote that or
spoke to him. But then I've got to say this first month has been very unnerving to me and to many, many others, I think.
What about on the issue of the Middle East? You've been very active on this issue of Israel. Prime Minister Netanyahu, as we sit here in this particular week, had visited, and the president had a kind of odd, I thought, press conference in which he sort of casually tossed off that, one state, two state, whatever they want is okay with me. And it seemed to be lacking in depth of understanding of what that meant.
I think he's instinctively, you know, reasonably pro-Israel in a way that I would like, but I also tell my pro-Israel friends that if America is weak, that's bad for Israel, even if you have a sort of pro-Israel president. If you know, if you don't have the clout to do what you want to do around the world, that's the main thing we help Israel with, we bring to Israel. And what's worrisome, even when he says something that might be sensible or there might be a reason why you'd want to change policy, maybe the question of whether we should be neutral, kind of let them work it out rather than trying to impose a two-state settlement, whatever. I mean, that's an interesting policy debate among Middle East experts and within the pro-Israel community, honestly. One has no feeling with Trump that it's been argued out within the administration, that he himself has heard the arguments, that anyone's even had the arguments. I mean, I'd say that part of
Netanyahu himself looked a little bewildered when at some of the comments that the president made.
Again, you sound like such a kind of, you know, old-fashioned, you know, Washington type. Oh, it has to be an interagency process. There has to be this. There has to be that. And that could be overdone. And a lot of the good things Reagan did, he did against the consensus and against some of his advisors, incidentally. Consensus. I am not
but
at
not,
all.
But not without forethought.
Not without forethought. Not without letting it be debated. Not without some advisors probably giving him good advice of people on the outside. And yes, as you say, that's a very good way of putting it, not without forethought. I mean, that is important.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about another aspect of where we are in the world and where America is relative to the world. You were a supporter of the war in Iraq, and you've basically been a supporter of muscular American leadership to promote democracies and democratic institutions around the world. What did you learn from that experience about the limits of that and the ability of America to impose democratic institutions or democracy on countries where there is no history of it and where sort of tribal history overwhelms civic institutions?
Look, I still think the main reason for going to Iraq was not to oppose democracy, but once we were there, I think we had to help them have a shot at liberal democracy. And incidentally, it's still a freer country than most in the Middle East and still a fairly democratic country, actually.
Were you surprised when the president put Iraq on the
It was one of the more offensive.
For the order.
Now, not that there aren't terrorists who could come from Iraq, but it was one of the. It is remains something of an ally. We've let it slip. I don't think we should have gotten out the way President Obama did. We've let it slip too much into Iranian control. Look, I'm sure, in the heat of the moment, exaggerated the ease maybe of the democracy agenda. I'm not sure I did it as much as some others, and Bush did. But you know, when you're a political leader, that often happens. I still fundamentally believe in it. I think that there's plenty of evidence that countries that don't have that much tradition of liberal democracy can adopt it. It turned out to be easier in Asia, for example, than in the Middle East because of complicated cultural and historical and political reasons. But I still think it's not as impossible as some people say. And certainly where it does exist, we need to defend it.
Yeah.
Where people are fighting for it, we should help them fight for it. And I learned this a lot in the Balkans. And so for me, that was a very big moment. I was not that the Bush White House ended. I was doing other things. I was actually more focused on domestic policy in 93, 94. And then in 95, we started the Weekly Standard. Bob Kagan and I wrote the first thing we ever wrote together, I think, an editorial in maybe December 95, supporting Clinton's intervention in the Balkans.
Kosovo, yeah.
And Bosnia first, and then actually, I think, in 95. And then we had people canceling subscriptions. They weren't – I didn't subscribe to the Weekly Standard to read editorial supporting Bill Clinton, you know. And people said, oh, history, you can't have anything decent there. They've been fighting for 1,000 years, the Kosovars, the Bosnians, this, all these – and look, there's still problems there, and it's not perfect and all that. But we did stop slaughter there, and we ended up with a better situation than we had started with. And if, maybe I overinterpreted that lesson, but it seemed to me that it was better to have intervened than not, and it worked pretty well. And I think there are plenty of other instances like that. So I remain pretty much where I was in terms of both a muscular American foreign policy and secondarily, I mean, this is not quite as important as the fundamental American commitment to keeping a healthy world order, but to democracy promotion, liberal democracy promotion, rule of law, and so forth. I do. One of the worst things about what Trump has done is that he's made that even harder, obviously. He himself campaigned against it. I was a little shocked at how few conservatives and Republicans stood up against Trump on that. And so many people just, oh, of course we can't do nation building. What is that? Well, okay, let's think about the implications of that. Are we just going to sort of say these people are going to remain, this place is going to be hotbeds of terrorism for the next century and incidentally probably places of nuclear proliferation? Are we really unwilling to think that maybe it's our mission to try to do some of this? But so I remain pretty committed to both the strong American foreign policy side of it and the promotion, defensive promotion of liberal democracy side of it.
The the challenge is that America's pretty weary after this experience, the experiences of the last 2 decades, and desirous of prudence in terms of the missions that are undertaken.
Right, and it's partly chicken and egg, and partly leadership. And obviously, you know, the Bush it was tiring after 9/11, and the war in Iraq went badly. The surge worked, though, and I'm not sure that anyway. President Obama campaigned on what he campaigned on, and did what he did. But I do think I think the question is, after 12 years of presidents saying we need to do nation building at home, not abroad, and the nation's weary, and so forth, the nation can tell itself it's weary. Partly because its leaders tell them it's weary.
Yeah. Well, we could talk a whole nother hour on that, and we'll have other opportunities in the future, I hope. But Bill Kristol, always great to be with you.
Thanks. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.